Okay, 3, 2.
3, 2, hit it!
Welcome to Double Down with Max and Stacy on Sputnik Radio. Coming up on the show, we'll be talking to Dan Collins of the China Money Report. Stacy, but what do you got?
Well, yes, we actually have Dan Collins in studio in New York City. Now, this is quite important because you and I have spoken to him many times over the past decade, and he's always been in Shanghai. Why? Because he lived in China for the past 20 years. We're going to get into why he's now moved back to the United States, and one thing could be it might be a little bit safer this way. If you read this headline, more than tariffs, China sees trade war as a new U.S. containment tactic. As both sides stand firm, fears that a spiraling conflict could result in dangerous and unforeseen consequences. As part of a wider strategy to slow China's economic and technological rise, the trade war joins other recent moves by the U.S. to rein in China's global influence. For example, on August 13th, Trump signed the annual defense spending bill that included the Foreign Investment Risk Review Modernization Act, or FIRMA, a new law that, while not mentioning China by name, is considered an effort to curb Chinese investment into U.S. industries that have a bearing on national security. Max, there are other laws similar to that.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting, you know, because the intellectual property is a one-way street, really, with China, right? They have the ability to cherry-pick our intellectual property. We don't have any equal representation in China. Meanwhile, their technology is actually leapfrogging our technology. So this is all hands on deck. Trump has recognized that this requires a real concerted effort to level the playing field, as he says, and not a moment too soon.
Well, the Chinese apparently thought that this trade war was just going to be like a few tweets and that it would be over and they would be able to continue trade as usual. Now they're realizing, and the article here points out that the editorials in the state-run media there are suggesting that this is actually going to be in for the long haul. In the U.S. media, of course, we're very hyper-partisan here, and what one sees on the likes of MSNBC or those against Trump, the anti-Trump media, what they'll say is that this is hurting farmers, and indeed it is hurting soybean farmers. But the analysis in the article points out that those people will still vote for Trump. In fact, some of the polling suggests that they've increased their support for Trump. Where Trump is targeting is those states like Michigan and Pennsylvania that gave him 2016, that gave him that election, the former industrial powerhouses. So that this ultra hard position he's taking on the trade war is actually, he's targeting those voters rather than the farmers.
Makes sense. I think we need to get Dan Collins in. He's obviously been looking very closely at this stuff for a number of years. Dan Collins, your first take on this extended trade war that, you know, it started off as a few tweets. Now it's going into extra innings, Dan.
Yeah, we are in the third inning of at least a 9-inning trade war here. My first thought process is how interesting it is how Trump has dealt with the Chinese administration as opposed to previous U.S. Politicians. Take Hank Paulson. He wrote a book on how to negotiate with China. Went over there 10 times. They would drop the they would strengthen their currency a week before he showed up, and literally nothing was accomplished. Years and years, and nothing got done. This is the first time we're getting major concessions out of China. Reduction in tariffs. They've already put $70 billion on the table. The Trump administration wants $200 billion. This number will get worked out at some point, and we should get back to business as usual. But finally, somebody's sticking up for the American workers.
So you mentioned the way that previous administrations have dealt with the Chinese administrations. The article points out a quote from Claire Reed, who is a former assistant U.S. trade representative who has been to China many times as a trade representative under the Bush administration. And what she's saying is what's also a difficult situation now in moving forward after this really tense relationship now between the U.S. and China is the personalities of the two leaders. So President Xi does not want to lose face. And yet the way Trump operates is if he goes over there and meets face to face with the president of China, he is going to obviously tweet, "I won." That's the only way he's going to ever meet face to face, and yet that would be losing face for Xi. So how do they go beyond those cultural issues?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. If I was to give one piece of advice to the Trump administration on this was take the gains, take the $150, $200 billion that we're going to get out of this, and then give them something that looks good outwardly. You know, give them something, like you said, the concept of face and his whole ego personality now that's developed around Xi Jinping, the premier. He can't be made to look bad, because otherwise nothing will get done and it will just continue to spiral out of control.
That would be completely out of character, though, because Trump is a winner-take-all kind of casino guy who looks for ratings, and there's only one winner and everyone else is a loser. You know, as somebody famously said, we don't want to be second. Second place is for losers. So I've talking to you on this topic for a number of years, Dan. You seem to think that this could, as some have said, trade wars do lead to hot wars. Is that in the cards, you think?
Well, it's the old Thucydides trap, which is, you know, age eternal. The rising power always comes into conflict with the old power. The United States is the old power. It's not just an economic thing. It's also military. It's technological. You see, the Pentagon came out with a report yesterday about how aggressive the Chinese military has been. This week, they ran nuclear strike bombing tests aimed at going after areas like Guam and Hawaii. And you're not going to see the end of that. China's building the Blue Water Navy. They're building military bases all over the world. I think we're going to continue to butt heads for the next decade or two decades, despite what happens with the current trade war issues.
Well, this article does speak to somebody else who is an expert on both U.S. and China, and they said, and this person said that both sides are underestimating the other side's willingness to use military force. And in particular, they point out on the U.S. side, for example, Taiwan. One of the leaders of Taiwan was recently in California and gave a speech there publicly, which is unheard of up until Trump, that they allow the president of Taiwan, a leader of Taiwan, to speak here publicly and address the audiences because of the sensitivity there. In this article, the expert on China says they are willing to go to war over Taiwan. Do you think that could happen? And is the U.S. really actually willing to go to war over Taiwan?
So mainland China could take back Taiwan in probably 3 days. The Taiwanese recognize that. If you ask, I spent a lot of time in Taiwan as well. If you ask the Taiwanese, they don't think that'll ever happen. They think, oh, we're both ethnic Chinese and cousins, blood brother, so to speak. So they don't think that will happen. However, China has openly said taking back Taiwan could be on the table. And if they're ever going to do it, it would happen under the current leadership, Xi Jinping.
Now, if the U.S. were to go to war against China, we're still mired in Afghanistan 17 years later, and that's a country of, what, 20 million people, and I don't even know if they have any advanced weapons at all beyond an AK-47. Iraq, it took a lot of soldiers dead and a bloody, long, gruesome war, and that's a flat country, open desert of 25 million people. How are we going to take on 1.3 billion? Are the Chinese willing to fight? Like, how would that war work out?
Well, in the Asia-Pacific region, the Chinese submarine force outnumbers the U.S. submarine force about 40 to 1.
Whoa.
And they're also run off diesel, so they're very quiet in those types of waters. We have the big, you know, giant class subs that are not so good in that area of the world. That's why China built the South China Sea islands up. So while we were talking about it, they literally went and built islands in the middle of the ocean as kind of a forward military base. We have our allies, Japan and Korea. The question is, China's trying to bring them into their orbit economically. China's by far a larger trade partner to South Korea than we are. So South Korea is heavily dependent on China. So it's kind of a struggle now between these two powers to bring in the countries that border China, and if they can go into the China orbit or the U.S. orbit. So that's what politically China's trying to do now. And it is a very dangerous situation now because there are so many disputed areas in the South China Sea.
Hey, Dan, it's kind of interesting that America is talking about enemies in the Middle East, and the Middle East will come back and say, you know, we've got sleeper cells in America. And not to stoke xenophobia or anything, but in the case of the Chinese in America, they're not sleeper cells. They're all over the universities. And the point being, though, is that you talk about ethnic Chinese, they do not, this idea of assimilation is not really in their character. The Chinese are Chinese first. They will always be Chinese first, according to what you've been saying. So just, can you comment on that? I mean, it's, again, not to be xenophobic, but it is kind of an interesting characteristic that this is, your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, it is a mind mindset that probably the West had 50 years ago to 100 years ago, where you know, myself as a Westerner from originally from Michigan, living in China 20 years, I was married to a Chinese national. They would never consider, and I speak fluent Chinese, they would never consider me Chinese. I'm always going to be a Western. You could be there three generations.
At the same here, you're considered Chinese American. You're considered American.
Correct. Right. Yeah. So it is a different mindset. Immigrants into China for the last 30 years, the total number is zero. You literally don't immigrate to China. They don't have it. And they kind of, you know, they think, oh, we have too many people already, so just don't allow it. But they're also very, compared to us, as Max has just mentioned, we bring in a Chinese national, and the next day they're working in defense companies. It's like no big deal as long as they've got that passport. They would never let me anywhere near a Chinese state-owned, you know, military company. You know, it just wouldn't happen. They would not hire immigrants or foreigners.
But you're now moved back to the U.S. We want to talk about that, but first I want to say, you know, you mentioned that they said they already have too many people, but in fact, they do have a huge demographic time bomb hitting them very soon and rapidly. Tell us about those numbers, and now they want to have two, you're allowed to have two children, but not many did.
These numbers are shocking to me. I mean, they just come out. So China scrapped the one-child policy last year. And this year they're expecting 50 million births. They only got 17 million. So the second child policy has been a total disaster. But when you look at their numbers, their labor forces are now already smaller than it was in 2010. But what I found more shocking is that Chinese women of childbearing age will decline 40% in the next decade. So if they're getting, I mean, their numbers of deaths will far outpace the births, and their population could just see a demographic cliff like we've never experienced in modern times.
So wages will rise even further. Right now, they're almost like it's rising rapidly U.S. levels.
When I moved to China, average worker make $100 a month. Now, no problem, they make $1,000 a month. When you add in living accommodations, food, all the other benefits Chinese workers get, I've estimated that between just base level workers in the United States versus China, the United States is only about 20% higher at this point.
Wow. And now you're back in the U.S., though. Why?
Well, I think United States is now, after we've lost two or three decades of unfair trade and all the factories going away, we are now the world's largest developing country. You see it in the infrastructure. We need infrastructure. Our companies are reshoring. Fortune 500 are now looking at, we've got to bring all the supply chain back because of the tariffs and now the low tax rates. I don't have to leave the country. So we're about to see, I think, a manufacturing boom in this country that we haven't seen in decades. So the only question is, will this real economy growth outpace all of the debt time bomb that we've set up for ourselves? That would be the interesting thing. But
well, that's the theory, isn't it? That the economy can grow, create a tax base. The tax base then creates possibility to pay down debt, and you have a sustainable economy. But with the interest on the debt now zooming to 1%, 2%, 3% of GDP, you know, you're peering down both barrels of a hyperinflationary nightmare. So what's your betting instinct, Dan? Can this manufacturing boom save America at the last moment? The man in the white hat, the cavalry's coming. Is America gonna live to see a brighter future, Dan?
If I had to bet, I think we will see a manufacturing boom. However, we also see inflation because the Fed will have to continue to be very quantitative easing to keep the interest rates low. Because with the debt we have, we can't go back to 5-6% interest rates because we'll be bankrupt overnight. So I think they'll have to print money to keep the interest rates low. They'll have to continue to buy debt, and we'll see what happens from there.
Well, you mentioned that we're like a developing nation in terms of the infrastructure, and that's something, you know, Max and I returned from Europe. I mean, it is shocking how third world, what we used to call third world, that not only the infrastructure of rail and roads, but especially the financial infrastructure. In the last minute here, tell us about what you see here versus back in China.
I mean, we're 10 years behind China in fintech and just payments. I mean, you make payments via WeChat on your phone. You don't see cash anymore in China. People won't make change for you. They look like you're crazy if you're bringing up change and cash.
How about checks?
Checks, come on. I mean, I think China just skipped over checks. Like, they didn't even need them. So, yeah, checks. I came back to U.S. and all of a sudden I'm like, what? I got to order a checkbook? I mean, what is this, like 1950?
Incredible, Dan. So you're an entrepreneur. You killed it in China. Big success. And now you're here in the biggest emerging market in the world, the United States of America. Thanks for being on Sputnik. We got to go. That's going to do it for this edition of Double Down with Max and Stacy on Sputnik Radio. Thanks to our guest, Dan Collins, of the China Money Report. Until next week, bye, y'all.